And good morning, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 7th, 2015. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are novelist Michelle Hunnevin and biographer Tracy Dougherty. First up is Michelle Hunnevin. She's the author of four novels. She college hopped and landed at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where she received her MFA. Her first two books, Round Rock and James Land, were both New York Times notable books and also finalists for the LA Times Book Award. Her third novel, Blame, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and also a finalist for the LA Times Book Award. Her fourth novel, Off Course, which we're primarily going to focus on today, was published in 2014. She's received a GE Younger Writers Award and a Whiting Award for Fiction. For many years, her day job was reviewing restaurants and writing about food for the Los Angeles Times, the LA Weekly, and other publications. She's received a James Beard Award for feature writing with recipes and an assortment of other awards for food journalism. Michelle presently teaches creative writing to undergraduates at UCLA and writes the occasional bit about food. She lives in Altadena, California, close to where she grew up. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, sure. Thank you for being here. I think the last time you were here, we were talking about another book in a different genre that you co-wrote with another writer about buying houses.
Exactly. Bernadette Murphy, The Dow Gal's Guide to Real Estate.
That's right. That's right. And now we're here to talk about fiction, which it seems is your primary focus, yeah?
It is these days.
So let's talk about Off Course, since that's your most recent book, and how that book came about.
Well, Off Course is my first fairly autobiographical novel, although as I discovered in writing it, that if you write straight autobiography, well, you'll just bore everybody to death. You need drama, you need narrative, you need characters who are probably a little bit livelier than the people that at least I know. And I had been seeing my girlfriends write these stories about their unhappy love stories earlier in their life, unhappy love affairs. And I thought, well, that looks awfully easy. Maybe I'll give it a whirl. Easy and interesting. I mean, who doesn't like a good unhappy love story? But it was not as easy as I thought it was going to be.
So interesting, because I was going to ask you why Off Course takes place in 1981. And now I sort of have the answer.
Because that's how old I was in 1981. Late 20s, at loose ends. Also, the other reason I wanted to put it there is that I felt that at the time that I was writing Off Course, it was, you know, after the 2008 crash, and there weren't jobs, and kids were graduating and getting out of undergrad and grad school, and there was kind of nothing for them. There was nothing in the market. They couldn't quite join the world. They couldn't quite step up to become adults, and that was what had happened in the early 80s. After I got my MFA at Iowa, I moved back to Pasadena, and it was really hard to find any kind of work.
Interesting. So, autobiographical novel, had you considered writing a memoir?
I did, but I really don't know how to write memoirs. I mean, I've gotten a little bit, since writing this book, I've gotten a little bit more interested in it, but I think I'm just down to my core a novelist.
Interesting. Yeah. So I'm curious because I don't know the personal details of your life, so I don't know how it translated into fiction, but how did you, I don't know, winnow down the detail or how did you focus in on what the story was going to be?
Well, I had a period of my life that I'm not at all proud of. In fact, I was sort of deeply ashamed of, where I had an affair with a married man that lasted for a number of years. And that's what I wanted to write about. And it's funny because I didn't even talk to a lot of my friends about it because I did feel this deep sense of shame about it after I kind of got out from under it. But I know that what is most personal and held kind of most shameful is often the most universal. So that's why I decided to try and write about this relationship that I had. And like I said, I wrote it the first time pretty much as it happened, although if I had written it in as many details and at the same sort of time, in the same sort of time length that it actually happened, people really could not have borne it. As it is, people have complained to me that the excruciating pain of the affair just goes on too long, you know, that my character, Cress, just keeps making too many wrong decisions. Of course, I don't know if you've read the new Elena Ferrante books, but her character with her married lover makes mine seem like skim milk.
That's funny. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I'm with Michelle Hunnevin, and we're talking about Off Course. I would love to hear you read from this book. Would you do that?
I'd be happy to.
Okay.
I'm going to read from very close to the beginning. My character, Cress Hartley, is an ABD, all but dissertation, PhD student, and she has to, you know, write this 100 to 200 page document, and she's not getting it done living down in Pasadena. So she decides to move to her parents' mountain cabin, which she always hated as a kid, but 3-4 months of free rent really seems like the ticket to get her dissertation done. Here I go.
All right.
Morning brought still more reminders of why she'd always hated the cabin. A panging headache, a weird, gluey lethargy, small, wheeling prisms in her vision. Her mother had attributed these symptoms to Cress's attitude, admittedly rotten. But Sylvia Hartley had been off by a letter, as Cress discovered, camping in the Tetons and skiing in Utah. Anywhere above 6,000 feet, she was a poor adapter. She took 3 aspirin, then chopped carrots, onions, and celery, and made enough lentil soup for a week, possibly a lifetime. She stuffed a man's large red mitten with ice and, stretching out on a window seat, placed it over her eyes. The aroma of soup must have carried outside. The porch creaked, and Cress lifted the mitten. A very large dog nosed the sliding glass door as if waiting to be let in. She stood, too fast, setting the prisms into a frenzied whirl, and the creature, too, rose up on his hind legs. A bear. He stood like a man, his arms hanging, his head cocked so that his long, whitened snout slanted upward against the glass. One eye, displeasingly small, yellowish, not intelligent, squinted in at her. The visible ear, round at the top and pinched at the stem, lent him a comical stuffed toy look. He was definitely a he. In the sparser fur of the low belly was a hairier vertical thicket with something stuck on it, a dry leaf, a bit of bark, his own crustiness. Perhaps overconfident of the thermopain, Cress moved closer. Her heart, which recognized danger, began to race. But when had she ever been so close? She knew from childhood admonitions, mustn't meet his eye. He was not a handsome or hygienic bear, no. His coat dirty, clumped, its dull brown, bleached unevenly on the ends. His black nostrils quivered, steamed against the glass, and slid against it in dark, shiny adhesions, leaving smears. The claws, translucent black crescents, looked like plastic. She moved closer yet, and he dropped back to all fours. Dog-like again, he lumbered down the steps, shoulders rolling, and the whole cabin shuddered. She noticed then other smears at the same heights, high and low, all along the sliding glass doors, the front set and the side ones. Her hands shook as she phoned her nearest neighbor, the retired couple a quarter mile up the hill. "I just had a bear on my porch," she told Florence Orlis. "Big old shaggy brown one." "Him, yes. He's by here almost every day. Neville squirts him with a hose or bangs pans at him. You want to discourage familiarity."
That's great. That's great. Thank you. That was Michelle Hanavin reading from Off Course. I loved this book. And now that you say it's autobiographical, I want to read it again. But but I wanted to talk about, well, a couple of things. One is the empathy that has been said that your novels have, which they do. I've read two so far. I'm on the third. And I am curious because it seems that is such a missing element from novels that, for me, that don't seem to work so well. And I'm curious if for you, it's you're conscious of this. You're conscious of empathy and of making your characters empathetic as you're writing, or having empathy for your characters as you're writing, or do you think fiction reflects our own psyches, whether we want it to or not?
Well, that would be nice. I probably write a little bit more empathically than I often feel. I mean, I'm not, in my head, I can be very judgmental and sometimes cynical. But I do think that, you know, novel writing or novel reading perhaps taught me empathy. And I think that it's the role of the novel, in my opinion, to help us connect with other lives, lives that are foreign to our own or different. And you know, in writing a novel, I've found out things about my characters that surprise me. I can really dislike characters or intend to paint them in a bad way, but it's sort of like people. Often the more you get to know them, the more their stories make sense and deepen out, and the more you understand why they are the way they are.
Yeah, that's interesting. You had mentioned getting an MFA, and it's in your bio, of course, from Iowa. Would you say that these days MFAs are necessary if you do not want to teach? I mean, it seems like, you know, not so many years ago, there were a few major MFA programs that were where you went if you wanted an MFA and not just to teach. These days, there are so very many MFA programs. I'm very curious. And obviously, they are inhabited by people who want to write and publish and perhaps want to teach. What do you think?
Well, I think that a lot of people have stories boiling up inside of them and a true deep need to get them down. And I think that MFA programs are a place to go. I mean, you can get a degree, and if you can get a job and teach, if that's what you want to do, that's a great thing. But MFAs also give you a couple of years of time to really get that story written, and also to build your own writing community. I think it's very, very hard to write in a vacuum. And when I look back at my time at Iowa, even though I had teachers who were influential and that I was very fond of, the huge impact on my life was the community that I made, the friends that I made, and how, throughout, I'm still in touch with many of them, and they changed my life. I mean, I had one friend, Robin Green, who moved to Southern California, and she was older than I was, and she became like an editor at California Magazine, and she brought me on writing journalism, which led me into food journalism. And, you know, without Robin, who later went on to, you know, write for The Sopranos and other, you know, prize-winning television shows, I never would have become a food journalist or a journalist at all. So you just don't know who you're going to meet there and what they're going to, you know, their impact on the rest of your life.
Yeah, good point. Did you begin with short stories?
I did begin with short stories, and this is how I knew I was a novelist, Barbara, is that I would write a short story, and by page three, I would have 12 or one time over 30 characters. I mean, you can't really do that in a short story.
Yeah. Yeah, and then your novels, Round Rock, your first novel, was that your first written novel?
Yes, and it took me a very long time to write it. I started it in as an undergraduate, and it started out as a short story, and my undergraduate teacher said, you know, this is really a novel. And I thought, oh, okay, so I'll write it as a novel. And I kept trying, and I kept trying, and I tried all through graduate school, and then for years afterwards, somehow it didn't really occur to me to write another novel. I just kept trying to write that one. I did write some short stories along the way. But by the time Round Rock finally, I mean, I even quit writing. I got so frustrated I couldn't write this book. I would write 50 pages, 100 pages. I would get totally snarled up, and then I would stop, and then I would start over again. And I actually quit writing because I was so frustrated, and it had just made my life unhappy. I was 7 or 8 years out of the workshop. I'd published one short story in Harper's, and it was just fiction writing was making my life unhappy. So I quit and decided that I would go to seminary to become a Unitarian Universalist minister. And I was taking a class in contemporary theology when all of a sudden it occurred to me that I'd been starting the novel in the wrong place, and that's why I kept getting snarled up. I'd been starting it in the middle and not at the beginning. And suddenly it came to me where the beginning was. So when I was done with that year in seminary, I sat down and began to write Round Rock, and then it took me 3.5 years to write it.
Interesting. Okay. So for all of you out there, are you beginning in the right place? I mean, that's really interesting. Do you remember the moment when it came to you?
I do. I was in Backgrounds of Contemporary Theology, and all of a sudden I just thought, I keep getting snarled up because I'm starting in the middle of the action, and what if I just, and I would have to like then say who this person was, and then go back and say who that person was, and there were three main characters trying to tell their stories back to get back to the main action, to this dramatic moment, was just a snarl. It just came clear to me, and I mean, oddly now, if you open Round Rock right in the middle, literally to the page is where I had always started it.
Interesting. Okay. I'm going to have to look.
Yeah, it's very funny.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and I am curious if you, with your novels, if you know where you're going, if you're a plotter or a pantser. Do you have some idea where you're going to end up?
Some idea. I think with both Round Rock, my first novel, and James Land, I knew the last sentence, and I could write to that. With Off Course, oddly, I overwrote the ending by 30 or 40 pages, and the book just wanted to end at a certain spot. And when I was reading it before I sent it out, I got to that spot, and then reading beyond it was just like a drag. So I made, you know, my husband and a friend read it, but just from, you know, like the end. I said, is the ending really boring? No, the ending's good, they said. So then I sent it to my agent, and she got to the same spot I did. And so I had to lop off the excessive ending, take details from it, you know, sort of lard them back in before the ending. And so it was a very, you know, odd experience for me.
Interesting. Well, you know, this time has just flown by as it always does. I wonder if, in closing, if you have any advice that you'd like to share with our listeners, any advice that perhaps you were given that has stuck with you, or any of your own that you repeat to yourself.
Writing advice?
Writing advice, yeah.
Yeah. I think that the hardest, the lately the thing that's been most significant to me is to know that when you're writing a rough draft, it's actually a different language from a finished draft. It's notes, it's clumps, it's even charts and graphs or calendars, that you can't apply a critical aesthetic to a rough draft. Revising it, you can, you know, start to make art out of it, but drafting language and finished language are really different, and people get really caught up trying to write perfectly the first time. And I think you need to have your material out there before you can actually start making it beautiful.
That's great advice. Yeah, we want to futz way too early.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for being on the show.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Michelle Hunnevin. Her book is Off Course. She is also author of Blame, which I wanted to talk about. And, of course, there wasn't time. James Land and Round Rock. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Thank you.
現在在聽 KUCI。
KUCI 今聞いています。
ラストベッド KUCI 88.9 FM
小山。今夜
は聞きに来た KUCI。 Estás escuchando la KUCI 88.9。
Vous slushte KUCI。
Vous écoutez la radio KUCI 88.9 FM。
You're listening to 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine。
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we were here for the first half of the hour with Michelle Hanovan, novelist, newest book, Off Course, and we're back with Tracy Daugherty. Tracy was born and raised in Midland, Texas. He's the author of four novels, four short story collections, a book of personal essays, as well as biographies of Donald Barthelme and Joseph Heller. His stories and essays have appeared in The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Paris Review Online, McSweeney's, Boulevard, Chelsea, The Georgia Review, Tri-Quarterly, The Southern Review, and many other journals. He's received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Breadloaf, and the Vermont Studios Center. A member of the Texas Institute of Letters and Pen, he is a four-time winner of the Oregon Book Award. At Oregon State University, he helped found the Masters of Fine Arts program in creative writing and is now Distinguished Professor of English and Creative Writing. And he's here today to talk about his new biography of Joan Didion called The Last Love Song. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for being here. Let's begin by hearing you tell about your new memoir, The Last Love Song, and its genesis.
I began writing biographies a few years ago, really as a personal project. The subject of my first book, Donald Barthelme, had been a teacher of mine, and so I really kind of wrote that as an homage to him. But then I began to realize that he had been an innovator in the American short story in the latter half of the 20th century. Then I turned to Joseph Heller and began to consider the American novel. And then it seemed a natural move then to turn to journalism and nonfiction, and Joan Didion was the obvious choice for that. In my time, she has been a real pioneer in journalism and really one of the most important voices. So I really wanted to write about her work and the influence she's had on the culture.
Interesting. Now, as I started to read, and you very quickly answered the question I was thinking, I wonder if this is an authorized biography, and it's not. And And I wondered if that made a difference in how you wrote it.
It certainly did. I had hoped that she might want to speak to me. I knew her agent and had spoken to her before, and so I thought that there might be a chance that Didion would cooperate with me on the book. But I really wasn't surprised that she did not. In interviews throughout the decades, she has made it clear that she really doesn't like other people writing about her. She wants to control her own narrative, I think. So I wasn't surprised. It didn't stop me because really, as I indicated, I think of biography as a kind of literary and cultural history more than a kind of tell-all sort of project. So, you know, I was less interested in the personal details of Didion's life. I was only interested in her life insofar as it affected her art. And so I felt that an unauthorized biography using that kind of approach wouldn't be out of line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sort of feeds into my next question, which is because I'm always wondering when I read a biography, when I talk to biographers, how much of the critic's hat does the biographer wear, or is that not the biographer's role to be a critic of their subject's work?
Oh, I think it is the biographer's role, especially when you're dealing with a literary figure. I think readers expect you to, if not pass judgment on the work, to at least, you know, present the work in a way that allows the reader to make some judgments. So I do think you have to have a critical aspect to it, which can, of course, get in the way of telling a good story. Sometimes the narrative kind of stops cold when you're talking about someone's life, and then you have to stop and analyze a book. But I do think it's part of what you're expected to do.
So your research for The Last Love Song must have been exhaustive and exhausting to do. How do you winnow down so much material to the essence? Which, I mean, it's a big book, so you know, I can't imagine how much more there was. I would imagine loads.
There was loads, and I spent, you know, actually I've spent about 40 years reading Didion, so in a way, mm-hmm. long before I even considered doing a book, I was thinking about Didion and winnowing, you know, my responses to her in my head. And then when I decided consciously to do a book, I spent at least a couple of years just doing research. Didion has been a public figure now for 40-some-odd years, and so there is an extensive public record of newspaper interviews and profiles, and I did manage to see some of her letters and all of her rough drafts in the Bancroft Library at Berkeley. So it was 2 years of research and then compiling a kind of chronology for myself and then deciding what to put in and what to leave out.
Hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Tracy Daugherty. His most recent book is The Last Love Song, a biography of Joan Didion. The book is divided into, I believe, 9 sections.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if the sections came early, and if they did, was it to help you organize, or how were you thinking about the book?
I did want to do a kind of straight chronology in terms of the structure, because I wanted the reader to get caught up in Didion's life story. Again, one of the challenges of writing about a living person and a person who really has achieved, you know, a degree of celebrity is that readers think they know a lot about her already. You know, many parts of Didion's story are already known. So, you know, it seemed to me important to try to create a narrative that would still be compelling to people who still knew a lot about her. So I thought a straightforward chronological approach would probably be best, and yet try to create some suspense along the way.
I love that it's chronological. I think one of the most confusing things with biographies is when it's all over the place, and you keep having, as a reader, you keep having to remember where you are, kind of mm-hmm. track where you are.
I think many biographers do try to play with structure and try to do something new and innovative because, you know, it sounds a little boring perhaps if you're going to do a straightforward life story. But I agree with you. I think probably the best approach is to tell it straight and let the subject's own experiences be the suspense.
Yeah. Would you read to us?
I'd be glad to. This is a section that takes place in 1970 when Didion is really starting to become known as a writer, and she has lived through the turbulence of the 1960s and is looking for a little peace and quiet, so she moves to Malibu with her husband and her daughter.
Okay.
The Dunn's move to Malibu in January 1971 was an attempt to heal following the previous year's excesses. This house on the sea had itself been very much a part of the 60s, and for some months after we took possession, I would come across souvenirs of that period in its history, a piece of Scientology literature beneath a drawer lining, a copy of Stranger in a Strange Land stuck deep in a closet shelf. But after a while, we did some construction, and between the power saws and the sea wind, the place got exercised, Didion wrote. She still had parties nonstop, so the move to Malibu wasn't as antisocial as I first thought it was, her friend Eve Babbitts told me. But driving out there was a terrible hassle. The Dunn's new place, a spacious ocean-facing house with a wide terrace over the water, wall-sized windows, a white brick fireplace used year-round to dispel the chill in the air, and redwood ceilings, was located above the beach on the Pacific Coast Highway just beyond Decker Canyon at the west end of Malibu, some distance from the pastel swarms of B-list actors swelling the colony. The hills are scrubby and barren, infested with bikers and rattlesnakes, scoured with cuts and old burns and new RV parks, Didion said of Trancas and Zuma Canyons. In truth, between wildfires, the hills splay out in patches of parsley green as one travels north and west from Los Angeles, enveloped by a sudden sense of isolation. Crows drift over ice plants and agave, the rainy yellow shimmer of mustard seeding the slopes as afterburn. People who live in a beach house don't know how wary it makes them, the critic Alfred Kazin wrote. Didion's decision to move here, to keep an eye on the edge, told him she was a very vulnerable, very defensive young woman whose style in all things is somehow to keep the world off, to keep it from catching up with her, and so casting protective spells. She describes Southern California in terms of fire, rattlesnakes, cave-ins, earthquakes, the indifference to other people's disasters, and the terrible wind called the Santa Ana. In a magazine piece, he characterized Didion as subtle, as possessing an alarmed frenzy and falling into many silences. She can look at you and past you without the slightest hint of a concession. In a private journal, he said, the unspoken is as important to her as her presence in the world. She was trying to tell him, this is what a happy woman looks like.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Tracy Daugherty reading from The Last Love Song, a biography of Joan Didion. You mentioned Eve Babbitts early on in that reading, and I'm curious if there were people who refused to talk to you for the book.
There were. Didion's inner circle, her editor, her agent, and some of the people that she's living among in New York right now were wary of speaking to me. And again, I understand that. They want to protect her privacy and be loyal to her. They were very courteous to me, very kind. No one was ugly about it, but they just said, you know, I want to respect Joan's privacy. Other people were quite willing to talk, so it was a mix of responses.
So dealing with sensitive topics can't be easy. And how did you approach the topic of her daughter's death?
I managed to speak to the son of the man that Quintana married, and he was quite open and very generous in his thinking. You know, it is a delicate subject because she was a troubled young woman and died young, and it's obviously a topic that Didion has trouble writing about. Her memoir, Blue Nights, is ostensibly about Quintana's death, but even in that book, Didion admits that she has trouble talking about her daughter, and that's an area where I didn't want to intrude too much on Didion's own privacy. It is her story to tell. So the biographer, again, I think has to be very careful about that. You know, in speaking to Didion's husband's son, you know, I was quite sensitive that this, again, was not about a tell-all. It was not about divulging dirty details of any sort. It was about, you know, what does the family think about what happened? And how is the family responding to the very public death of Quintana?
That's interesting. So as a biographer, do you have a wish that your subject read and approve of what you've done?
This is the first time I've written about a person who is still living.
Who's living,
you know, the title of the book does, I think, say what I wanted to say. I do think of it as a love song, in a sense. You know, I don't withhold some critical judgments of Didion, but by and large, I wrote about her because I admire her. I admire the career she's had, and I admire the way she's approached it. So, you know, I want it very much to be a love song to her in that sense. Whether or not she will read the book, I don't know. I hope that if she does, that whatever she thinks of it, whether it's a success in her mind or not, at least she hopes that I did an admirable job.
Yeah. You know, you have written in so many different genres. I mean, you write fiction, you write essays, you do so many different things. How does it all work together, and how do your projects come to you?
The bottom line really is narrative. To me, it's all about storytelling. Whether you're doing nonfiction or fiction, you have to find a compelling structure that will keep the reader turning the pages, and that's where I begin with everything. Whether a subject is treated as fiction or nonfiction depends for me very much on the material itself, whether I think I know enough about something to speculate about it, or whether I need to stick only to the facts. The material really makes that decision for me in advance. So I mainly just worry about constructing the narrative.
In the first half with author Michelle Hunnevin, she talked a little bit about revision and how the first draft is no place for you to start futzing and making it work. It's really a place of you know, just getting it all down and clumps of this and that. How do you approach your drafts?
I'm very much the same way, although I do have writer friends who are perfectionists, and they have to perfect one sentence before they go on to another, and they're very slow and deliberate, and they take their time, and they write beautiful work that I could never approach writing, and I'm envious of their beauty that way. But I'm very much the same way as Michelle, where you know, to me, the rough draft is a fast process. It's something where you want to just get down everything that you possibly can while you're thinking about it, because you can always go back and change it. The great thing about revision is that you get to be better than yourself. You know, you write a draft, you let it sit for a few days, you come back, and there's almost like a second person. There's almost a second you who's looking at it with fresh eyes, and so you get a chance to do it again. And then a third you steps in, and a fourth you, and so you get to be more than yourself in revision, which is great.
Do you bring in readers at any point?
I do. I have a few trusted readers that have been, you know, very honest with me for many years. And so when I feel I have something that's not too messy for them to waste their time on, I show it to them.
Interesting. We have a few minutes left with Tracy Daugherty. His new biography is The Last Love Song, a biography of Joan Didion. So are you able to keep the marketplace out of your office when you're working, and social media and everything else that writers are now expected to do a lot of?
I am. I do ignore social media altogether, which, you know, may or may not be wise. Certainly it is the wave of the future, and writers are expected to have a presence there. But I just turned 60 years old. I'm an old dog, so although I'm not a Luddite by any means, I just don't. You know, I don't have any practice using social media, and I don't really have any desire to. So I do block it out. I've blocked out most of the reviews for this book. I just don't want to know what's out there. Try to keep my head down and stay busy. You know, I was told many years ago by a teacher that writing is a kind of lucky problem to have. You know, we will never write as well as we'd like to write. It's an unsolvable problem. We're always going to fall short. And so I just want to keep my head down and do the work and wrestle with this problem and shut the rest of it out.
Well, I must say, I love your website. It's one of the best I've seen. So if you have nothing to do with it, you have somebody who knows what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I'll plug Josh McCall. He's a great designer of websites for literary people. So I owe it to him.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It really
Thank you.
Is. We are drawing down on our time. I also was curious about something you say in the preface. In the preface to The Last Love Song, you say, "Who was she really?" Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you feel you answered that question.
No, honestly, I don't, and I don't think I intended to, really. This is the paradox of writing about writers, is that they create a public persona, of course, and they do control their own story. And in the case of Joan Didion, this is particularly true because she has written autobiographically for so many years. So she has created a public persona that, you know, in some ways matches who she really must be, but in other ways does not. She did say, though, early on that the women we create are just as important as the women we are. So she herself has blurred the distinction between who she is on the page and who she is really, and it's a fascinating question that remains open.
I love that. I love that quote. How do you teach writing?
Basically, I think you teach editing. Of course, talent is a very strange creature, and who knows what it is or where it comes from. And that can't be taught. Imagination can't be taught. But people can be taught to be good readers of their own work. So to me, it's about editing. And here again is where the Luddite in me perhaps does come out a bit. To me, the only way to teach writing is to sit face-to-face with someone and, scrawl through sentences and cross them out and rewrite them. And so it's really a very practical matter.
And regarding the last love song, were there any surprises that came out in the writing that you really, really did not expect?
Well, you mentioned that it's a long book. I actually set out to write a shorter book, and it grew and grew because I didn't realize, one thing, how deeply involved in the Hollywood community Didion was. I knew she had written some screenplays, but I approached her as a writer of books, and so the Hollywood story grew much bigger. That was a surprise to me. And in many ways, this is a biography of several people, not just of Joan Didion, because her family, the family she married into, was so large and accomplished and interesting. So it became a much bigger story. Didion, we think of as a private, isolated person, but in many ways she was quite involved in a huge social community.
Interesting. In closing, I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening. Any advice that has stuck with you along the way, or advice you give your own students?
I will come back to your thought about social media and okay. The kind of public noise that's out there. It's very hard for a writer to shut out the public voices and the noise and to avoid all of the hype and the hoopla that's out there. That is part of being involved at all in the culture. So you do have to pay attention to it. But I do think it's absolutely crucial to listen to the voice inside and not to the voices outside.
I love that. I love the noise. I have to,
it is noise.
There's so much of it.
Interesting noise, but it's noise.
Tracy, thank you so much for being
on
the show. You're welcome. That was Tracy Daugherty. His book is The Last Love Song, Biography of Joan Didion. And that's all the time we have for now. If you'd like to know more about the show or what's going on in the area, please visit my website, penonfire.com. And come back next week. We'll have more for you.